have Maulana Muhammad Beg and Sayyid Hadi Yasin like every night, every bigger nights to lead the Amal. Please spread the word and let everybody know. Also, please come forward, everyone, please come forward. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The most important announcement tonight is about Yawm al-Quds. Brothers and sisters, it's only 2 days away. This Friday, inshallah, we'll have Yawm al-Quds in close to Masjid in Wats, it's Masjid al-Rasul. The address is 1335 East 103rd Street, Los Angeles, California. We'll be sending out the email tonight, inshallah, which will have the address in there. Please spread the word, and we would like all of you to come out and show support with the Palestinians and all the oppressed people in the nation. With that, I would like to invite Huda Islam Maulana Muhammad Beg to come up and address the gathering. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير اعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاه والسلام على اشرف الانبياء والمرسلين ابي القاسم محمد وَعَلَىٰ آلِهِ الطَّيِّبِينَ الطَّاهِرِينَ الْمَعْصُومِينَ Before I start, one more request. If all of you can please move forward. There are other people outside. As they will be coming in, we'll have a hard time. So you can move forward. Thank you. Until now, the discussion that we were having was before the prophetic mission had started. Before officially the prophet announced himself to be a prophet and Allah had designated him for a specific job. Now, this is necessary to talk about what happened before in order to understand the message, understand many of the rules of Islam, and understand in what situation Islam came, so that a better understanding of the Prophet, his prophethood, and his message can be achieved. Now, we are obviously learning the life of the Prophet in order that it can be a lesson for us in our life. It would be very unfortunate that we know the history of the Prophet, we know the lessons that we can learn from his history, and we understand them, but still don't want to apply it in our life or don't want to live our life according to it. This would be a very unfortunate state of affairs. So hence, my encouragement and our dua in this month of Ramadan from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and in these beautiful nights that Allah has given us of Laylatul Qadr, where He's accepting our duas, is to ask Allah that while we are learning and as we are learning the life of the Prophet and his example, help us to also follow it in our life. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, before we actually begin the history of the prophetic mission and what happened in terms of how the Prophet was appointed to the mission and how the work actually started and the work of Islam and the growth of Islam and the principles by which it grows, before we even go into that, a little bit I'm going to discuss in regards to the situation and circumstances that the mission began in. What kind of an environment was the Prophet beginning his message? What was happening in those days? What were the people like? And that led to a certain type of behavior, certain type of temperament, a mentality of being isolated from others and living in their own world. Many people who go and live on an island, they end up having a certain type of mentality when they are cut off from society. One of the main things that they do not relate themselves to other people, meaning they don't get along well with others. When they see others, they see them as foreigners and become defensive right away. They are aggressive when they deal with other people. This is how a mentality of a person who's all alone is like. For example, you want to see it in animals. If you, for example, put a dog on a leash in a cage and let him grow like that, you see that he becomes very unfriendly when he's amongst others. But if a dog, for example, is let out and he lives amongst others, you see that it's easy for him to get along with others. The same thing happens with a human being. If you isolate a human being from society and he doesn't grow up learning how to deal with others and the rights of others and what others are, that person you see has a very hard time in socially belonging to a society. He is socially inept. He cannot get along with others. So now what happens is that the Arabs historically have been isolated in this place without contact with other people, or minimal contact, nothing else. And hence they became a society that has this temperament of not being able to get along with others, in fact considering others as not even human beings. And hence they call themselves as Arabs and others as Ajam. Ajam literally means someone who cannot talk, mute. Right? Someone who's mute, cannot talk, is handicapped, is known as Ajam. Right? And they used to call the rest of the people Ajam because they could not talk, according to them. They had no language, they don't know, and hence these people are, not even human beings. And hence, because of this isolation, because of the fact that there are mountains around it, and there's a geographical divide between the Arabs and others, that's why this region is called Hijaz. Hijaz means partitioned. Hijaz means partition. Partition from other places. Like walled. Where they're inside a wall in a cage. Not from outside. This is what it actually means. So now living in that situation, you see the Arabs had this mentality. The people of Hijaz had this mentality. This mentality of what? Of I am the only one, we are the only ones, and others don't even exist. And this also translated within the families and clans and tribes that they belong to. For example, the way that their mentality was that if we belong to one tribe, then our lives matter. Our properties matter. You belong to my tribe, it means I must respect you. You belong to my tribe, it means I should not kill you. But if you belong to some other tribe, then his property is up for grabs. His life is up for grabs. And when you go and try to tell them, hey, listen, that person is a human being also, they will just look at you and say, so what? He doesn't belong to my tribe. It's as if, that's it. If you belong to my tribe, then you have value. You are worth something. But if you don't belong to my tribe, then it's as if you are dead. It doesn't belong, you have no value. I can just kill you and that's it. This is the mentality that the people in that time had. The prejudice that they had amongst each other. Meaning, for example, one tribe to another. It was so much intensely ingrained in their blood that they could not find sense in the fact that other people of other tribes also have a right to live. They would not understand that. That's why everyone kept to themselves. Each tribe kept to themselves. Now in that, because of the prejudice and the class system that existed there, the poor had no value. If you are poor, if you are not wealthy, if you don't have money, you have no value in the society. In fact, the rule amongst the Arab was this. If my tribe people kill someone from your tribe who is poor, then you have no right to ask for compensation. You know, because we will look at that and say, you know, he was a poor person. And you will also understand, okay, you know, he's a poor person. Given that, you know, it means that he has no value. In other words, he has no worth. He doesn't deserve to live. A tribe would accept that also. Okay, you killed us. But if you kill someone who's rich from amongst another tribe, then the repayment was that we have to kill someone who's rich from your tribe also. Now, it doesn't matter which rich person you kill. Just give me one. Right? Just give me one person from amongst there. Let me just throw an arrow and see who it hits. Right? Whoever it hits, that person randomly is killed because he just happens to be rich and his tribe has killed a rich person from another tribe. This is their mentality. This is how they were. You know, and they won't matter. So if you belong to a tribe and unfortunately you are rich and wealthy, so what will happen is that they will just pick you and say, okay, you can take this guy. And that's it. You'll be taken there and they can do whatever they want with you. And this is how they did. Now, obviously, to us, when we look at it, it is humorous, right? And sometimes laughable. But they took it seriously. This was their way of life. They would not change it for that matter. So this is their attitude because of the fact that they have lived in a separated and divided place, walled from all other societies, and cannot get along with anyone else. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, when we look at this, Islam came in these people, amongst these people. There are certain things Allah condoned of their actions, and there's certain things Allah condemned of their actions and their lifestyle. And we need to see how Allah fitted Islam into a cultural glass so that we may actually see Islam in action. My friends, here, let me just explain something that many youngsters and youth who are living in America have a complete misunderstanding about. You know, there is an idea amongst the youth, especially here, youngsters especially here, about the fact that when they look at Islam, they think that Islam can survive or be or exist without the sculpture of a culture. In Islam, for example, is just rules and that's it. And Islam has no culture. My friends, Islam are principles that can only be implemented within a culture. If you take it out of a culture, then Islam is a theory. If you take it out of a society, Islam is a theory. That's not what Allah wanted the deen to be, some sort of a intellectual, amusing theory that we can all think about and say, oh, that sounds so good. That is so intellectually pleasing. Allah wanted this theory, and Allah wanted these principles to be applied into a society. And a society has a culture, and it has to be now living in that culture. That's why Allah gave Islam and made Islam grew within a culture. And that too, the culture of the Jahiliyyah Arabs, the ignorant Arabs. And to show that Islam is such a force that it can even survive and be alive in the most horrible culture you can find. Islam lives within a culture. For other people to say, oh, you know what, you know, we don't want to follow culture, we just want to follow Islam. What does that mean? What does that actually mean? Okay, what do you want to follow? These formulas. But the formulas can only be implemented in a society, in a people, in a culture. Islam came as a principle to live within all the cultures of the world. It came to live there and give life to human beings within the culture, not to take them out of the culture and make them dry. You know, otherwise, Islam without culture is like Wahhabism. What is Wahhabism? Islam without culture. No culture, nothing like that. Just, you know, rules. That's what you end up as. The fact is that Allah made Islam grew in the culture of Hijaz in order to show how Islam comes to life and how Islam gives life to the people who are living within a culture. That's why there are certain things Allah condoned in the society and there are certain things Allah condemned in the society. And He showed the principles so that we can apply it to any society. If we are from Afghanistan, if we are from Pakistan, if we are from Iran, if we are from Lebanon, Indonesia, America, anywhere like that, we need to apply those principles by which Islam came into this fold of a people and then condemn the things that are wrong and condone the things that are right so that Islam can come to life and it can give us life also. Salawat ala Muhammad. So because of this misunderstanding, a lot of, for example, youngsters, you know, they run away from elders and say, oh, you're all about culture and culture. It's not about that, you know. And yes, those, you know, for example, elders, you know, they emphasize the culture more than Islam and all of that, that misunderstanding is there. So that's wrong also, and this is wrong also. You know, the idea is to see how Islam can live within the society that it is growing in. Islam will find a way. And that's what Allah did through the Prophet. So now when we need to look at the society of the Arabs to understand the society well and accurately in order to see how Islam came into society and made its position there. So when we look at the belief of the Arabs of Hijaz, we know them as mushrikeen. Right? Now mushrikeen is translated as idolaters. And right away there is the idea of idol worship. There's the idea of idol worship. Now, did you all know that the people of Hijaz in the days of Jahiliyyah, in their core beliefs, in actually what they believed in, they all believed in Allah? Did you know that? In their core beliefs, there was Tawheed. That they believed in Allah. But they used to bow down before idols. Yes, they did. But they believed in Allah. How does that work? And I'm not saying it. Allah says it in the Quran. Allah is speaking of it in the Quran. Go and read there. Allah tells you, meaning the Prophet, go and ask these people of Makkah and these Hijaz, who is the creator of the heavens and the earth? Yaqulun Allah. Allah is the one. They'll say. They'll say Allah. Allah. Who is the one who gives you rizq? Ask the mushrikeen, they'll say Allah. They didn't say Hubal or Lat or Manat or all the other gods that they had, the halwa god. You know? Yeah, they used to have a god that was halwa god. Right? They used to make him in the morning, the halwa. And it's to worship her all day, and at night they'll eat it. And this was called Halwa God, right? At least he was useful. So when you look at that, and obviously for us it's funny and amusing, but really I want you to understand the mentality. The Arabs of Jahiliyyah believed in a God, in the God, in Allah. They used to call him Allah also. They said the God. They all believed in God. Then who are these idols then? What were these idols in the society? You see, these idols to them were not God. These idols were, you can say, the smaller version, representative, you know, of God. They would be, you know, when, you know, God is way above and beyond. They all believe that. He's way beyond everything. And these are the smaller ones. And they, in their mind, they believe that these are not the main ones. Hubal, when they ask Hubal is God, they'll say, no, Hubal is not God. God is there. I mean, He's God. Right? This is just a manifestation of God. It's just a manifestation of God, His Jalwa. That's what it was. Like all other religions, when you look at them, that's the way it is. Like Hinduism, for example. Yeah, they worship idols, this and that. But in the core of their beliefs, there's only one great big God that's called Brahma. Right? In their core beliefs, there is that one God. And they say that these are not gods. They're just a reflection of God. We believe in God through these people, through these idols that we make. Same was the case with the Arabs then. When you say mushrik, they all believed in Allah is saying that in the Quran. Allah is telling us about them in the Quran that in their beliefs they believed in God. They had the idea of Tawheed. But the place where they made a mistake is that they said, listen, in order to please the big God, the main God, we need to please the smaller gods. Now, okay, maybe that could be understood. You know, sometimes a lot of religions and even our people might have the same belief. But it went forward. You see, here's how it went forward. I want you to understand this mentality. It's very important to know these people. How they actually worked. Let's send the salawats. You see, whenever they had to see the difference between the big God and the small gods, whenever they see the difference, right, they did not mind disobeying the big God or disrespecting the big God, but they would be afraid of disrespecting the smaller gods, right? And when they ask, why do you do that, their answer would be interesting. They'd say, well, you know, here's the thing. That big God, he's Arhamur Rahimin. He is all merciful. You know, if we do something, he has no need for us. But these smaller gods, if they get upset, then you know what? We'll get in trouble. So you see, this was their thinking. That we can't do anything against these gods. But we will, you know, if you go against that God, that's all right. He can forgive us. But these smaller gods that are in front of us, they don't forgive. So we need to please them. We need to make them happy. And that's why you'll see that they'll sacrifice the big God for the smaller gods. They'll make sure that the smaller gods are happy. You know, when Abraha, you know Abraha, we told you about the story. When Abraha was on his way to Makkah to destroy the Kaaba, he came there. You know he got lost? Yeah, he got lost. Like, his army got lost. Right, on the way. They're like, okay, anyone knows the way here? Everyone's like looking at each other. No, we don't know the way. Right? Yeah, they got lost in a place called Ta'if. Right? They got lost in a place called Ta'if. So they came to a tribe that lived there by the name of Bani Thaqif. And they asked these people, hey, listen, what's the direction to the Kaaba? How do you get to Makkah from here? You know, so this whole army is waiting there, right? Elephants and all that. They're waiting there to find directions. They couldn't find a gas station. So these people actually were asking for directions from these tribes. Now this tribe, you know, they had a god, their local god that was there. And they knew that this army is going to destroy the Kaaba. Now all the Arabs believe that the Kaaba is the house of the main god, the big god. But this tribe, you know, knew that. So, you know what? They divulged the information right away. They said, okay, it's that way. Go that way and that's how you'll find it. You see, right away they divulged the information. Why? Because they said, listen, if that house is destroyed, that's the main god. He can take care of himself. But this small god is ours. If we don't protect him, because if we don't give the address to Abraha, Abraha will destroy our god. And then our god will punish us. This was their thinking. And that's how they used to think about it. Now, obviously, this belief also was to an extent. It wasn't that big. Because religion to them had turned into a toy. They can play it any way they like. And when they don't like it, they throw it away. They throw it away. So what happened is this, right? One famous incident that happened. One person, you know, he was bringing his camels to his god. To gain blessings, you know, that's how you do it. You know, you bring your camels to the god and the God will bless you, and the camels will become healthy, and you'll have more camels and all these things. So he brought those camels to God. Now, in those days, when people used to sacrifice for their gods like animals, they would take the blood of the animals and they would smear it on the idol as a sign of sacrifice. They would smear it on the idol, so the idols would smell, right? So these people, this man, he brought his camels there, for barakat and for blessings. The camels smelled the blood and probably were allergic to it. And they started to stampede and they ran away. And this man became so upset at God because he said, I brought my camels so that you can make them grow and you made them run away. So he started taking stones and his slippers and threw it at the God. It's your fault. Right? So on one hand, you have respect for God. On the other hand, you see when he's not helpful for you, you're throwing stones at him. Right? And you're cursing him out. So this is their belief system. Understand how the Arabs are working in those days, right? This is their system of belief. Even though they believe there is a main God, there is God. And this, you have to see how it rolls into it. So when the Prophet said Allah, they had no problem with Allah. They had no problem with Allah. They all said, we'll all believe in Allah. We already believe in Allah. That's what they said. Abu Lahab had no problem with Allah. Abu Jahl had no problem with Allah. The problem they had was the first phrase, La ilah. It said, don't say that these others are not God. No, the others are God also. And Allah is the main God. We accept that. But don't say this is not God. So to them, they're not against Allah. They're against the fact that you are against the rest of their gods. This is their belief system. In short, now, each of these gods had a meaning and a reason. I don't want to go into all the reasons of God. There are books that have been written, one special book called Bulugh al-Arab that explains all their beliefs and all their idols and why they were made and how it happened. And if you ever want to read something about it, if you have a lot of extra time and you don't have anything else to read, then I'd refer that book to you and you can go and read it. Salawat alaikum adwar. Now, this was the ideological aspect of the Arabs in those days, right? Now, I'm making you understand this because you see, now the Prophet is going to come and he's going to preach Islam here. Now you have the second aspect, which is the social evils. And this was a main topic of discussion in Islam by Allah in the Quran. Allah, right away, as Islam came, started to speak and to throw light on the social evils of the society. And the social evils, as you see, because of the prejudice, because of the fact that they believe that might is right, and that anyone who has power is stronger than anyone else, and so the other person who's weak has no status in the society. As such, you see, the women were relegated to a status of a commodity. Yes. Women were things that you can sell and buy. The respect of women obviously was zero. They had no place in the society, no say in the society. They were in such a bad situation that obviously now every tribe, they would have their women because women are needed for procreation and bearing children and all these things, right? But that was it. So every tribe would protect their women. But the women had no place in the society. What that meant is this, that if a woman from one tribe was caught walking in another tribe, then the other tribe was free to kidnap her, confiscate her, and do whatever they want with her. Because the issue is that, why were you out of your neighborhood? That's how it was. That's what it meant. No woman would be caught in another tribe's neighborhood. They would all stay in their own because they knew that there's protection here. You go outside of this, then you're on your own. Now you're in someone else's neighborhood and they see you're in someone else's neighborhood. Anyone can come and kidnap and do whatever, and the other tribe can't do anything about it. You know why? Because of the fact that woman had no status. They could not even ask for reparation. They could not even ask for compensation for killing her. Because they'd say, what? I killed your woman, you know, so what? What was she doing here? This is how it was. This is what it meant. Now in that society, you see, with that sort of thinking, I want you to see the message of Islam and the Prophet, how it came to change the mentality of such people. Their honor, in fact, their, you know, you would say it's really not honor. It is like a false sense of honor. Their false sense of honor was such that they would not bear to see a daughter being born. Because the daughter, the reason is because a daughter, when she grows up, she has to get married, and I as a father will have to stoop in front of someone else. My respect will have to come down in front of someone else so that they can marry her. So why go through that disrespect? Why go through that humiliation? It's better to get rid of her when she's born. So here's how it used to happen. And some of these things are so outrageous. I obviously, you know, I'm giving you a disclaimer right away as I speak of this. Right? And disclaimer as to that the fact that some of these things are really obnoxious. But again, I'll try to say it in the most lenient way that I can. The most nicest way that I can, right? The way that birth used to happen in the Arabs amongst the Meccans, and it's obviously not everyone. Bani Hashim never practiced this, right? These are tribes in the Meccan world, in Jahiliyyah, who practiced this out of their ignorance and their false sense of honor. The way that birth used to take place there is that the maid will be called, the midwife will be called to give the birth, and the mother who's in pains and who's going through labor would be there, and there's a small hole that is dug next to the bed, that if this is a girl, just throw it in the grave. Just throw it in that hole and put the dirt on her. The father doesn't even want to see her. Doesn't want to see her. Just put it there, it's over. If it's a boy, then bring the boy over. This is how it used to take place, my friends. And this was a normal habit. Normal habit that people just used to dig the grave right there next to the midwife while she's giving birth. And as soon as the baby is born, that's it. If she's a girl, put her in the grave, put dirt in there, it's over. No one talks about it, nothing happens, and life goes on. This is how it used to be. And many of these types were there. Right? This